Good afternoon. Thank you all for coming today. It is now 1 p.m. on May 17, 2019, in accordance with public notice issued by the Massachusetts Department of Energy Resources. The department hereby opens the public hearing on proposed amendments to portions of 225 CMR 14 Renewable Energy Portfolio Standard Class 1 or RPS Class 1 and 225-15 Renewable Energy Portfolio Standard Class 2 or RPS Class 2 regulations. This is the third of four public hearings that the Department of Energy Resource will conduct on the proposed amendments to RPS Class 1 and Class 2 regulations. As stated in the public notice, the proposed amendments revise the Renewable Energy Portfolio Standard regulations to address policy-related changes including required changes to the RPS Class 1 and Class 2 regulations in order to implement Section 12 of Chapter 227 of the Acts of 2018, now codified as at Mass General Laws, Chapter 25A, Section 11F. The purpose of this public hearing is to receive verbal and written testimony on the proposed amendments to the Renewable Energy Portfolio Standard portion of the regulations. As indicated in the public notice, written testimony will be accepted until 5 p.m. on June 7, 2019 for RPS Class 1 and Class 2. This public hearing is being recorded and will be posted to the department's website. The Department of Energy Resources requests, to the extent possible, parties also submit written copies of their testimony.
Great. Well, thanks, everybody. My name is Eric Stelzer. I'm the Deputy Director in the Renewables Division, and I'm joined here today by John Wassum, John Parrott, and legal advisor Dan as well. Today, is Dan mentioned, is our third public comment session. We have one other session that's going to be happening on the 29th of May out in Springfield. Written comments are going, the deadline for written comments has been extended out to the 7th of June. I believe 5 p.m. is the deadline time on that, so if you get your comments in from that. Just to set the stage here, I'd ask folks to turn off their cell phones so that there's no disruptions from people that are speaking. And I'd also ask that everybody just be respectful, doesn't speak while people are speaking at the microphone here, and just be respectful of all the comments that are being said today as well. Appreciate that. It looks like we have 13 people that have been signed up to speak today. So I think what we'll do is maybe go for 7-minute speaking times, and then after that, you know, if there's extra time that folks need, we can do that too. So
where do you sign up? Up there?
Yeah, right up here. Yeah, if or there's another. I took the sign up sheet when it from 1 o'clock, but there's more of sign up there. But if you want to sign up here, that's fine too. Yeah. Yeah.
Why don't we start with the first one? Start with the first one.
Yeah. While she's signing up.
Okay. 7 minutes is a bad idea. So go with that, and then certainly if there's extra time, then people can take a little bit more time too from there. So we'll get going. First person that we have on the list is Rachel Branch. Yeah.
Thank you. I'm Rachel Branch, a resident of North Adams. I've been fighting polluters since 1997, beginning in Bridgeport, Connecticut, where I helped stop two asphalt plants from being built in my poor neighborhood and one other poor neighborhood. I testified in Hartford 3 times to help clean up the power plants, again successfully. In Massachusetts, I helped stop Kinder Morgan Tennessee Gas and have done 30 shows on Solutions Rising, my community TV program. My life has even been threatened doing this work. As a lifetime community servant, I am now also a vocational school committee member, a fair housing commissioner, and a housing authority commissioner. I also have spent 9 years as a respite care foster parent for children who have been traumatized by violence and or sexually assaulted. I am speaking today as an individual for our children and those to follow. My testimony, gentle people, is on the revised proposed changes to alternative portfolio standard regulations to 25 CMR 16.00. the Baker administration's assault on anything that delays the implementation.
Excuse me. Sorry. Today, this hearing is on the RPS, not the APS. The APS hearing was on the 13th, and that matter has been closed. Do you have comments on the RPS, which is the 14 and 15? You just said the alternative portfolio standard. I just want to make that clear. I just want to be clear that your comments were discussing the renewable portfolio standards, which are 14 and 15.
Okay.
I just want to make sure that your comments are on point to that. I'm not stopping your comments. I just want to make sure that you're going to be continuing with comments for the renewable portfolio standards regulations that we're talking about at 225 CMR 14 and 15,
okay.
Not 16. Do you understand?
Yes, I do understand what you're saying, and maybe I should submit this as written testimony.
Okay. Yeah, and you can keep talking. That's fine. If that's
well, I can.
Is this all on 16? I'm just okay. The public notice for 16 was concluded on the 13th.
Okay, I was not aware of that.
Okay.
But can I submit that anyway as written testimony? I don't have to go on with it if you.
You can submit it. It has been closed, so we can't consider it. But you can speak to the renewable portfolio standard that.
I came.
For this. And I apologize for that.
Apparently wasn't clear enough in the hearing. But that cannot be submitted now.
Correct. I apologize.
All right. That's fine.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We'll move on to the next person then. John Clark.
My name is John Clark, and I'm a licensed practicing forester, educated at the University of Massachusetts with dual majors in forestry and natural resource conservation. I'm a lifelong nature enthusiast, hiker, and green industry stakeholder, and I feel compelled to share my thoughts on the presented regulatory changes. I would like to thank the DOER for preparing these regulatory changes and for accepting public comment. I'd also like to commend the Baker-Polito administration for taking up the issue of reducing carbon emissions to mitigate climate change. As I'm sure you are well aware, within the Commonwealth, our carbon emissions are contributing to the greenhouse effect, warming our global climate. In light of the federal administration weakening its environmental agencies, it's become increasingly important for carbon reduction to occur at the state level. I practice sustainable forestry in my daily business and know that there's opportunity for sustainably derived wood chips to provide local renewable fuels for thermal, electric, and cogeneration facilities. These fuels are renewable and will directly replace fossil fuels, leaving ancient carbon in the ground and utilizing biogenic carbon for our energy needs. As a forestry professional with decades of experience within the Commonwealth, I can appreciate that the proposed regulatory changes will be met with considerable resistance from many who would wish our energy to be found elsewhere. While I differ from many of these individuals in my assessment of natural resources, I genuinely appreciate their commitment to environmental stewardship and best practices. To that end, I see the proposed changes to 225 CMR 14 as making perfect sense. Every day within the Commonwealth, our need to mitigate arboricultural hazards creates enormous quantities of wood chips, most of which is either trucked out of state or allowed to decompose in place. From the moment these trees were identified as growing in the wrong place, their bound carbon and its release was imminent. Decomposition and combustion release exactly the same amount of carbon. This wood waste and its carbon is the byproduct of our desired social activity. The designation of these trees for removal was not determined by a logger or a land clearer, but by a local parks manager, highway superintendent, public works planner, campus planner, or solar developer. I see the proposed regulation as recognizing these facts, allowing the resulting materials to be more locally and more responsibly utilized. While I enthusiastically support the majority of the proposed RPS changes, I am, however, confused to see that the proposed regulations no longer list land clearing material as an eligible feedstock. While this omission may be in deference to some who may believe its inclusion would promote the removal of forest, they could not be more wrong. While I support the notion that land clearing is the greatest threat to the Commonwealth's forest, this material, like that originating from the urban forest or utility projects, is preordained through the planned creation of our housing developments, college campuses, ball fields, solar farms, and so on. I therefore humbly propose that the DOER return land clearing derived clean wood to the list of eligible material with the provision that the clearing was first permitted. I see this nuance will prevent any speculative forest impacts and limit the material to that which was to be inevitably created. I'm asking both DOER and the Baker-Polito administration to please take the responsible step of promulgating the regulatory changes while allowing chips generated through permitted land clearing activities to remain eligible within 225 CMR 14. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Next on the list is Stuart Orkney. Ormsby, excuse me, sorry.
That's fine.
It's probably my reading, not your spelling.
No. My poor handwriting. Good afternoon. Thank you for taking time for all of us to provide some comments today. My name is Stuart Ormsby. I am with First Point Power, which is a competitive retail supplier out of Rhode Island. We serve a number of large commercial and industrial customers throughout Massachusetts, as we have for the last 7 or 8 years. I've got a comment on a very discrete item proposed within this rulemaking procedure, and this has to do in the Class 2 proposal, and specifically the proposed increase to the ACP with respect to the waste-to-energy category. The manner in which, or at least it seems, the manner in which the DOER is sort of managing that program, the department is looking to sort of maintain pretty even balance between supply and demand with respect to the qualified facilities and the demand through the purchase obligation. And in taking that approach, anytime you make a change to the ACP, it pretty much automatically results in an increase in the cost for that category. It's just the nature of economics. If you've got a pretty narrow supply-demand balance, you increase the ACP, the clearing price is going to fall right along with it, such that it clears either at or just below the ACP. So the end result of this change is basically an increased tax. This isn't a market that we can manage risk terribly well, unlike Class 1, where you have a substantial number of qualified facilities competing, and there's a good, vibrant market for the transactions of RECs. What this does for particularly commercial customers who place a high value on sort of managing their operational risks at their establishments, it makes it very difficult to maintain that value if their fixed forward price contracts are disrupted by things like this. And as the DOER is accustomed to hearing from retail suppliers such as FPP, what really helps in these circumstances is to provide an exemption, a limited exemption to existing contracts that would not be subject to this higher ACP and therefore the higher cost. That way these customers can continue to maintain the fixed price contract that they signed for maybe a 1 or 2 year period. Any new contracts as of the effective date of this rule would be subject to the higher ACP. And so this in effect allows for a bit of a transition both from the customer side and for, I think, the additional revenues that the department is seeking for these qualified waste energy facilities. That's the substance of our proposal. Again, an exemption for the ACP. First Point Power will be contributing to written comments being filed later on through the Retail Energy Supply Association. So our comments will be included in there. I encourage you to look carefully at those comments. I'm expecting the association to provide some help on this specific issue by citing an example in another state where they did allow for an exemption specifically for ACP. It's a little different. I don't think Massachusetts has needed to sort of deal with that. So it did work in this other jurisdiction, so it is possible. Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Next is Chris Perner.
I have to admit I'm a little nervous. I'm not a public speaker in any sense of the word. My name is Chris Perner, and my business is Perner Logging and Land Clearing Incorporated, and I'm a logger, and I make my living working in the woods. And I see the hard work and dedication of those who, like myself, work in this industry. Although land clearing is in my name, it is not primarily what we do or who we are. And the proposed change to the regulations to disqualify biomass from land conversion operations is, in my mind, a mistake. My mother told me at one time that the road to hell is paved with good intentions, and I think this is one of those times. Landowners are not going to convert their land to another use because of financial gain from biomass. There isn't any, or there's very little. Biomass is a byproduct of land clearing. There is no reason to disqualify biomass from land conversion. In the end, there's no difference between the biomass realized from selective harvesting versus land clearing. Disqualifying this type of biomass will only lead to more expense for all parties involved. For example, by having to truck all the biomass to other states so that they can realize and take advantage of its use. This biomass product, in my mind, should be used in this state for conversion to power and or heat in place of fossil fuels, thus keeping those jobs and money in this state's economy. Land clearing and biomass from land conversion is merely a step in a process. When land is being converted to another use, such as housing or solar or industrial, we're called in to do a job. As such, the biomass product, in my mind, should be put to its best possible use. Land clearing is not something that we promote. It is merely a part of what we do. It is a part of progress. Moving on to another point, keeping woody biomass to the 50% efficiency requirements is just plain wrong. We need to promote sustainable forestry. The way to do this is to provide markets for this low-grade wood and biomass. If it doesn't happen, forestry will go back to the days of high grading, which is going to be taking the best and leaving the rest. This does not promote good, sustainable forestry. Biomass helps to allow for the restoration of forests and habitats by creating diversity and, in some cases, a fresh start. Biomass creates a market for trees that would otherwise never be cut. Lack of markets will lead to the dominance of low-quality wood and diseased trees left in our forest. If you think of that forest as a garden, it makes sense. When you plant a garden, at some point we're going to need to remove the weeds. If we don't, and all we do is pick the vegetables, at the end, all we'll have is the weeds. The forest works in the same way, except in a longer period of time. If you don't remove the low-grade disease products and just remove the best, eventually low-grade is all you'll have left. This is the wrong way to go about this. This is the most important reason to promote this biomass and to promote a healthy, sustainable forest economy. I ask you as a father and a grandfather to revisit these two parts of these regulations and do the right thing for the generations to follow and for our forests. Thank you. And I didn't say too many times. Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Next, have Gia Newswald.
I'm nervous too. My brother-in-law is a forester in southern Vermont. I've talked to forestry students at UMass, and what I've heard is a rather bleak picture. I've heard 20-year-olds say, well, I don't have much hope for the future, so, you know, my job is just going to be to satisfy a consumer demand now. Massachusetts has made wise commitments, and it's government's job to keep us on track and to continue to upgrade those commitments as we learn more, not shove them aside as inconvenient truths when we look at short-term prices to adaptation. And by that I mean economic adaptation. And adaptation isn't good enough anymore. We really need to be progressive. When I think about Massachusetts, I think of progressive. I think of integrity. I think of social and environmental responsibility. It's wonderful that a scientific and consensus-based process was nourished and completed here in the state, with some very valuable information coming out in 2012. I don't see any clear statements as to why we should forget what was scientifically derived as fact. We know more now. Well, so we've made commitments to our Global Warming Solutions Act, reducing our emission standards, laxing our framing of forestry practices such as thinning or land clearing for development, are sort of pushing away, again, this inconvenient truth that we already know. We need to be much more progressive, even if it means not clearing land for a new development. We have responsibilities to our people, and we have responsibilities to, at this point, a global community in dire straits. So, Massachusetts having integrity means understanding that renewable energy is not enough. We need clean energy. It seems that the 2012 standards took that into account. It seems that these proposed changes would slacken something well thought out here. It means honesty that combustion of any kind is not clean, and we need to keep those standards, those emissions standards and production standards, as tight as possible while investing everything we've got in the cleanest energy production. We need to remember, relaxing our reduction of cumulative plant emission goals from 20 to 30 years is not in line with the commitment we made in 2012 or with the Global Warming Solutions Act. It's not in line with the thinking of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change or the Paris Accord. It disregards Massachusetts' commitment last year to increasing RPS by 2% to reach 35% by 2030. So we need to stick with the integrity of those commitments. If anything, if any changes are to take place based on what we know now, they need to become more stringent. Our regulations need to become more stringent. And responsibility, another value that I equate with Massachusetts, includes the health and safety of our people and also the health of our economy, which means working with the next generation of forestry students to perhaps even think beyond forestry. New technologies are great, but our efficiency improvements are not keeping up with our carbon footprint. And what about that student who said we need to satisfy consumer demand? I mean, you know, there's an economy here. There are people. That's how it works. They buy. Well, I think that it's also government responsibility to guide consumers at times. That's why we have health restrictions, regulations. That's why we have environmental regulations. And the sustainability of our economy also depends on the sustainability of this place. So, thank you for your time.
Great. Thank you. Next up, Roberta Flashman.
Good afternoon. My name is Roberta Flashman. I live in the town of Ashby. I've been on the Conservation Commission for over 30 years. And I'm speaking from experience of over 30 years as a farmer, as a conservation commissioner, as a hiker, an environmentalist, and an activist. When I see things and hear about things like Northern Europe trying to maintain their renewable energy structure by shipping wood chips from North America to there so they can burn as biomass, it makes my head explode because they're using so much non-renewable energy to get it there. When he left, Mr. Perner gave the example of a gardener and wanted us to look at forests in terms of gardens. I'm a gardener and I have found that tilling the soil constantly is not good. That you lose everything in your soil, all the structure of your soil and everything else, and that actually no-till is far superior, and it doesn't release all the carbon. Similarly, in forestry, leaving the tops of the trees unchipped in the forest is far better for forest health than clearing everything out and hauling it away somewhere to be burned as biomass. And in doing new construction and land clearing at that point, when they take everything off the lot and haul it away in trucks, the erosion that happens is the damage ends up in the streams and ends up on the roads and ends up everywhere. And it didn't have to happen. Not chipping, just as in reduce, reuse, recycle. There should be something similar in forestry. And despite the fact that reduce, reuse, recycle was a great slogan, unfortunately, everybody focused on recycle. Similarly, in forestry, now they're focusing on chipping and biomass rather than take what you need, leave the rest there to go back into the soil, and don't chip it. Because when you don't chip it, yes, will it go back into the atmosphere eventually through degrading? Yes, but it'll be way slower. When you chip, you speed it up everything. And when you remove it and burn it, you speed it up even more. That's basically my comments.
Thank you. Next we have Kathy Christofferson.
Good afternoon. My name is Kathy Christofferson. I live here in North Central Mass in the town of Ashby, where I am a conservation commissioner. I am a member of my town's energy resource committee that implemented our solarize program. I am a member of a local organizing group who works to promote clean energy policy with MassPol Forward. I'm here to comment on the proposed draft regulations for the renewable portfolio standard class 1 and 2 because clean energy does not come out of a smokestack. Including burning trees and incinerating trash in the legal definition of renewable energy gets in the way of investments in local clean energy and better approaches to waste management. On the mass.gov website from municipal waste combustors, it says while specific pollution controls vary from plant to plant, all facilities are equipped with systems for reducing smog-causing emissions, neutralizing acid gases, trapping fly ash and other particles, and lowering concentrations of mercury and organic chemicals. It is important to note, however, that no combination of technologies available today can completely eliminate emissions from combustion. That doesn't really sound like clean energy to me, nor any energy technology we should be subsidizing or promoting at all. Neither does industrial-scale biomass plants inefficiently burning trees to make electricity while spewing greenhouse gas emissions into the air we breathe, when we have better, cleaner options like offshore wind and solar. These technologies were the sources of clean energy that were envisioned to fill the doubled 2% annual RPS increase fought for in the last legislative session, not the trees in our forest. Trees in their intact forest ecosystems have a better role to play in the battle for a livable planet. We need carbon sequestration, not carbon sent up smokestacks, and certainly not sent up smokestacks subsidized on the backs of ratepayers. Earlier this month, I heard the forest industry testify at a legislative hearing that emissions from biomass are less than natural gas even. Ignoring the fossil fuels burned during harvesting, processing, and transport of biomass is exactly like ignoring emissions produced during extraction, processing, transport, and distribution of fracked gas. So we have seen this before. Now, why is the attempts by the industry to obscure the true environmental costs of these sources of energy? So what about the emission reduction mandates of the Global Warming Solutions Act? What about the warnings of the UN IPCC and the Fourth National Climate Assessment if we don't take rapid action? How do these draft changes that you've proposed help deal with those issues? Wednesday, I was at a press conference on another energy matter, and one of the speakers said she was embarrassed for our state, and I actually get it now, because we don't want our Commonwealth to be ignoring science. We don't want to be gutting environmental regulations, and we don't want industry calling the shots and writing the regs. We don't want New York or California or New Mexico even, or any other state, to get to zero before us. We don't want any control, we don't have any control over the lunacy at the federal level, but we don't want to see the same things happening here. We want our state, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, leading the nation on energy solutions to the climate crisis that we are all facing. These proposed changes to the RPS do nothing but take us backwards, lowering thresholds and lessening accountability. The best thing you can do is scrap these draft regulations and come back to the people of the Commonwealth with a draft that promotes no combustion, no carbon, no methane, no greenhouse gas emissions at all. Just the clean energy future that we have all been fighting for. Thank you.
Thank you. Next we have Thomas Chamberlain.
Good afternoon. Thomas Chamberlain. I'm the tree warden from the town of Sturbridge. I'm representing the town of Sturbridge here. And even though I am a little nervous, it's no different than probably getting up in front of a town meeting, which I'll have to do in a couple weeks, to fight for some funds. The funds to pay for the disposition of chips and woody debris that we generate municipality-wise in our community. A little bit about myself. I've been the tree warden for the town of Sturbridge for over 35 years. I'm a certified arborist through the ISA and also hold their tree risk assessment qualification. In 1997, I was elected vice president of the Massachusetts Tree Wardens and Foresters Association, and in 1999, elected their president. The Massachusetts Tree Wardens and Foresters Association is the oldest tree protection organization in the United States. In 2009, DCR recognized my work in the town of Sturbridge as a sustainable forestry community. And in 2007, the Massachusetts Tree Wardens and Foresters bestowed on me their highest award, the George E. Stone Founders Award. I have also been appointed by the United States Forest Service to their National Advisory Committee, the Urban Forest Strike Team Initiative. This is an initiative following natural disasters that are presidentially declared where FEMA becomes involved in assisting communities in recovery. We train arborists and community foresters how to best work in the guidelines of FEMA, but also in protecting and preserving their urban forests. And finally, I'm very proud to say that our community in Sturbridge has been a Tree City USA designee awardee for 30 consecutive years. So my background is in preserving, protecting, and enhancing our community forests. However, we have events, we have trees that grow, become old, become risk, become hazards. I think, you know, we've all turned on the news at 5 o'clock at night and following a thunderstorm, following a, you know, nor'easter, you know, you see all of the tree damage, you see, you know, trees on houses, trees on cars. This waste has to go somewhere. We have to process it. And right now there is very little market in the area to take this on. The last 3 years, the town of Sturbridge had a combined gypsy moth infestation and drought, which hopefully we're just getting out of, okay, through natural controls. We're not spraying, we're not herbiciding, you know, for the gypsy moths or anything. We're letting Mother Nature kind of rot it in, and hopefully Mother Nature will solve the problem long term. However, that left behind in the town of Sturbridge this last year in July, we did a survey. We counted over 650 public trees that had succumbed to the combination of gypsy moth and drought. We have to take those down. We can't leave them standing. We had to hire a contractor to do that, and as part of the process, over $40,000 of a $270,000 project was to dispose of this material because there was no real market for it to be. It has to be sent to Ohio or some other place. We can't. There's no market in the state. So clearly, you know, I'm here advocating for the changes that you are now currently proposing that hopefully will open up some markets for this material. Lastly, along our community profile, we now have over 40 communities in Massachusetts that have been confirmed have the emerald ash borer. The emerald ash borer is a boring beetle that attacks ash trees. The federal government and the state, our own state agencies, there is no real native control, natural control, and the process is to let that bug run its course. And so over the next 5 to 8 years, we're going to see significant mortality in our ash trees in the Commonwealth. And in Sturbridge, that's another three, according to my tree inventory, that's another 350 more public shade trees that I'll need to be addressing. So we have a problem here that needs to be addressed in municipalities. And so I'm hoping that you move forward with the regulations as proposed so that it provides that market and some taxpayer relief on the future costs of disposing this wood. Like previous, a couple other speakers, I noticed in your regulations that land clearing is not allowable use, and I would strongly recommend you at least take a look at that and particularly allow maybe for municipal land clearing. If we wanted to go build a ball field, we need to build a new school, those kind of municipal, a new public safety complex. Ultimately, we're going to get into land clearing, and clearly that type of land clearing is going to be well debated within the community. Obviously, money has to be appropriated to build those buildings, to build those facilities. So at least the community does have, some significant input into, debating that land clearing. And also, I'd also like to suggest in the text under 225 CMO 14.02 definitions, eligible biomass woody fuel, small d parenthesis 3, that the words, other natural events be added following where it says normal course of maintenance. This is where you allow the utility wood to be used under normal course of maintenance. And I'm just thinking that that doesn't really encapsulate other natural events. Again, we don't, to me that's, as much as maybe that's the way we're going, I don't want to say that, our normal maintenance is responding to a nor'easter, responding to a tornado, responding to a hurricane, all of which are, things that I think are natural, more considered natural events than in the normal maintenance. Okay? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next, David Herman.
Hey, good afternoon. My name is David Hyman. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Good. My name is David Hyman. I'm on the Energy Committee for the Sierra Club Massachusetts chapter. And I kind of come by it legitimately. That is, I love hiking and camping and skiing. There's some good hills here and mountains. And also a long-term commitment in myself to keeping those places so I can enjoy them and keeping the earth on which they lie viable. I first got that bug while a Boy Scout and have had it ever since. My colleague Paul Dale has presented chapter comments on RPS with respect to biomass, so I refer you to his comments there, and I will add further thoughts to what he said and continue there, some on solar and some on other aspects. So thank you very much for this opportunity to present. I might add within biomass that there is certainly a difference between what I'll call defensive biomass, of trees are damaged or diseased and need to be cleared, and what I might call offensive biomass if they're cleared for development. Practically two different things. So as far as solar power goes, about five things there. One is about decreasing the eligibility period of SREC 1 certificates to 40 quarters. Solar facilities are long-term commitments, and developers of these facilities have made commitments on periods that often exceed 40 quarters, because that's what they thought would be there. So cutting the eligibility would hurt the viability of many of these projects and cast doubt on DOR's commitment to encourage the development of renewable energy power in the future. Now, if you can't depend on SREX 1 early on, well, what if something else is proposed? A second is negative impact on community solar. It restricts the use of solar rooftop solar in many instances as against ground mount, including urban situations. And by doing so, the proposals impede the implementation of community solar projects, which are essential to expanding solar's benefit, especially to low and middle income people who live in urban areas and will depend on rooftops. Third is impeding the development on solar on agricultural and intact forest lands, because the proposals will restrict what could be built on those lands. And solar and agriculture can exist side by side using techniques such as shade management and other techniques. So impeding putting solar on places where there are intact forests, this would unnecessarily impede projects that need it, especially in the western parts of the state, so Gardner and continuing on west. So solar and agriculture, solar and forest can exist side by side, and solar doesn't have to be impeded in order to protect the other two. Another is there's a requirement in there that developments of more than 500 kilowatts must be paired with storage. In many large-scale facilities don't require storage facilities. You know, if it's large, those swings back and forth, you know, the law of large numbers. Let out that my background is mathematics and statistics. But the swing for a large situation, the law of averages allow that you don't have to have solar, where it's a small project, the storage can swing back and forth and you may need it. So a lot of times a large project may not need storage, and we should go by the project engineers to make that engineering determination, and if they determine a large project doesn't need storage, so be it. Let's not put it into regulation. And it impedes ground-mounted solar. So while roof-mounted solar is preferable in dense and urban areas, ground-mounted projects are preferable in less developed areas like western Massachusetts. And the proposals will impede the development of ground-based solar power for the reasons I mentioned earlier, like agriculture and forests where you could put that up. So solar represents a considerable local industry in Massachusetts, and it's a developed economy that helps Massachusetts industries and Massachusetts workers, and it's a key aspect of renewable energy with as significant a role as offshore wind and hydroelectric power, which Baker-Polito administration is pushing for. Well, if those two really are good non-greenhouse sources, so is solar. So in order to stop greenhouse gases in the next 12 years, solar must be encouraged and not impeded. So the other effects on other parts of the energy picture, there are a couple here. One is the coordination role of DEP with DOR is essential. DEP has a certain aspect, you at DOER have another, and both of them need to act in order to have a balanced picture. So disconnecting the monitoring of DEP adds unnecessary risks and detracts legitimacy to projects that claim RPS certificates. You know, if the monitor isn't there, are people going to say, I don't think that helps? Whereas if DEP monitors, it gives, and they're okay with it, it gives a veracity to these projects. So DEP must maintain their current role. And the other is on hydroelectric dams, small ones, that must now be recertified every 10 years. And that helps the sites to retain their original purpose. In 10 years, you say, oh, are they there? The proposal proposes eliminating that every 10-year check, and who knows whether a small electric hydroelectric facility in 10 years becomes something totally different, and if you can't check on it or monitor it, you won't know and won't be able to act if you do. So a small hydroelectric facility in 2019 could be something horrific in 2029. So anyway, basically thousands of citizens and Sierra Club members across the state in 2012 and following advocated for increasing the RPS standard, culminating last year in getting 2% in there, because they know the crisis climate is urgent. They didn't lobby to increase the RPS, only to see it watered down to include greenhouse gases generating things like biomass and waste to energy. That's not what we and not what they were fighting for, to get these RPS standards up to 2%. So DOER understand the time is short. According to the IPC, we only have about 12 years left to turn our greenhouse gas generating machinery around. That's not long. If you go backwards in time, that's 2007, which wasn't that far back in the past. So it's that far in the future. We don't have much time. So proposals to lengthen time spans, such as increasing biomass recovery from 20 to 30 years, or lengthening the time span through impediments on solar for solar to make its development, would be physically dangerous and, to a large extent, morally averse. We must not go down that road. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Next, we have Brant Richards.
Thank you for the opportunity to share feedback today. My name is Grant Richards, and I work for Cook Forest Products in Upton, Massachusetts. We're a company that has both a landscape supply side and a land services side, which I oversee. In that side of the business, we spend most of our time on utility and road right-of-way clearings, storm cleanups, and land clearing. We're glad to see that the proposed regulations waive the efficiency standard for non-forest-derived wood. We create a lot of that wood in our utility and highway work, and while we attempt to reuse the wood residues generated in our operations in the landscaping side of our business by turning it into mulch and other products, having multiple markets can help soak up the oversupply of this material generated by companies like ours, as well as tree service companies, municipal public works departments. We're grateful for this proposed change and believe it makes a lot of sense. However, we would encourage you to take another look at another proposed change, the removal of land clearing wood from approved use in the RPS. While we understand the concern over deforestation, if a project is permitted and will proceed, allowing the resulting wood to be used productively to displace fossil fuels is better than letting it go to waste and rot, potentially releasing not only carbon dioxide, but methane, a potent greenhouse gas. I can tell you that no one is choosing to develop their land because of the return they'll secure on the timber and residues that are removed. Land clearing is a net expense for landowners. When we take on one of these jobs, we can't leave residues behind. Everything must be chipped and removed. Therefore, changing the regulations for land clearing wood won't affect the amount of land clearing done. It will only encourage more of that wood to be wasted and release its carbon and potentially methane into the atmosphere. We strongly encourage you to reconsider this change and return land clearing wood to approved use in the RPS. Thank you for your consideration.
Great, thank
it's
you.
Also, Chris Perkins there too.
Next, Heather Klisch.
Conservation and Recreation Policy for the Appalachian Mountain Club. I'm going to mostly speak about hydropower today, and then a little bit on biomass at the end. cutting straight to the chase, AMC would urge DOER to remove the proposed addition that is stating that once a generation unit has received certification from the Low Impact Hydro Power Institute, which I call LAIDU, that it shall not be required to be recertified in order to retain its statement of qualification. AMC is deeply concerned that removing the requirement for recertification would effectively undermine project operators' motivations to comply with certification conditions in a timely manner or even seek recertification at all. Hydropower is a little bit different from many of the other forms of renewable energy that are incentivized by the RPS or other mechanisms. When the sun's rays are harnessed, the sun keeps shining. When the wind is harnessed, the wind keeps blowing. When a river's flows are harnessed for energy, the function of the river fundamentally changes. Poorly sited, designed, or operated hydropower projects can block fish passage, displace wildlife, and significantly alter habitat and other water quality, impacting overall ecology and even other human uses and dependencies on rivers. The department's use of LAIDU certification has been, for several years now, an appropriate means of using third-party expertise to affirm that hydropower meets the environmental standards that are specified in the Green Communities Act in order to qualify for the RPS. Being certified by LAIDU means that the hydropower facility must pass rigorous and consistent standards for river flows, water quality, fish passage and protection, watershed protection, threatened and endangered species protection, cultural resources protection, and recreation. Rivers and hydropower operations are equally dynamic as they respond to daily, seasonal, and even longer-term changes like fish migrations, flood, or drought conditions, or the upstream or downstream operations. LAIDU requires annual reviews, and recertification is necessary every 5 to 10 years in order to update compliance requirements that may emerge as a result of just normal dynamic systems in play. An important thing to know is that 65% of recent recertifications required new conditions to ensure continued or future action to stay compliant with the LAIDU criteria that are protecting our rivers. So removing the requirement for recertification for hydropower projects to remain RPS qualified eliminates the mechanism to ensure that the Green Communities Act standards for river protection are met. There would be no meaningful incentive to even, I'm concerned, there would be no meaningful incentive to even follow through on any of the conditions that would be included in the certificate for compliance. If you're not required to be certified, where's the check that's required? Going along with this, the department has not demonstrated that they have the internal knowledge or capacity to ensure LAIDU compliance, and therefore whether the standards required, again, by the law and the Green Communities Act would continue to be met should this recertification requirement be removed. The proposed change includes no indication of an alternate mechanism to ensure that these environmental protection standards would continue to be met. It's also important to note that the cost of recertification should not by itself present a barrier to staying in compliance. The current cost to LAIDU certificate holders represents less than 0.5% of annual Massachusetts rec sales. So the cost of applying for and maintaining a LAIDU certificate is extremely low relative to the economic benefits that are derived from the certification. Overall, on this topic, policies and public investments across the Commonwealth put a tremendous priority and a welcome priority on the health of our river systems. That commitment should continue to be applied to the RPS qualification requirements by ensuring that hydropower projects continue to be certified. So there's hydropower. For biomass, AMC is also quite familiar with forest management practices. I should have mentioned with hydropower that we've been involved in hydropower relicensing and review for decades. We are also have some good experience with forest management, and so we're taking a good, long, deep look at the biomass changes and the time that I thought we had today. I thought I wouldn't be able to get into that. So we'll submit detailed recommendations in writing. However, I do, because it's come up a few times today, because it's a common sense part of AMC's policy on biomass, I do want to touch on what we see as a positive requirement of removing land conversion, trees removed for land conversion, removing that from eligibility for biomass. AMC's policy is fairly straightforward, that trees that are removed for land conversion aren't going to grow back. So they are not renewable resources, and they really shouldn't be qualified or classified as such. So we actually see that as a positive change in these proposed regulations, and we'll comment on the rest in writing by the deadline.
Great. Thank you. Next, we have Chris Egan.
Thanks, Chris Egan from the Massachusetts Forest Alliance. I testified in Boston. I'm not going to repeat my comments, but just one of the things that's become apparent this week at these hearings is, you know, there seems to be some confusion over what these regulations do. So, really, what they're doing is encouraging the use of non-forest derived wood in biomass plants. And in fact, the only biomass plant that's on the drawing board would not use any forest-derived wood whatsoever. The efficiency requirements remain in place for forest-derived residues and thinnings. And as long as that's true, we're not going to see any increase in use of that wood for power generation. And it's for that reason we've encouraged DOER to consider waiving those efficiency requirements that other renewable energy systems don't have to meet, or in fact may not be able to meet. Because there can be forest benefits to the work that we're doing. While we generally support the use of non-forest derived wood, it makes a lot of sense if that wood has been cut and piled up by town DPWs. You understand why towns are enthusiastic about that change, because there's an oversupply of that wood that they have a hard time getting rid of. One town told me that they spent $20,000 taking their giant pile of wood chips. I was just from 1 year of cleaning up street trees and parks to haul it away to be dumped. So we think it's better to use that wood productively, but we don't see these regulations as doing much to increase any kind of use of forest-derived wood, and we think that's a mistake, and we encourage you to look at those efficiency requirements. The other thing that's come up is people have complained about not measuring some of the emissions generated from logging equipment or from trucks transporting wood locally. But we don't measure that for any other renewables either. We're not looking at the emissions from Chinese factories manufacturing solar panels. We're not looking at the emissions from the ships, the trains, the trucks that haul them halfway around the world to be used here. The production of steel is very carbon intensive, more than 5% of all global carbon emissions, but we don't factor that in when we look at the use of that material in wind turbines or the emissions from ships or other construction equipment used to erect them. So we think it's if that returns, it makes sense to measure that. I'm not suggesting that that will suddenly make solar panels a bad idea. That's, you know, nonsensical, but it would be an issue of both fairness and for, you know, just general knowledge to measure that across all of those renewable systems if that does return. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next, we have Mike Leonard.
Hello. I have a degree in forestry from UMass, and over 30 years forestry experience. In our forestry business, my son Jason and I help private landowners protect and manage thousands of acres across the state. The most important work we do is marking forest stands correctly for improvement cutting, commercial thinning, or regeneration cutting. Proper thinning can double the growth rate of the higher quality trees, increasing timber values, as well as doubling CO2 sequestration rates by creating healthier, more productive forests. A lot of CO2 is also stored in long-lived forest products, and by using carbon-neutral forest biomass for heat and power instead of fossil fuels. Diseased trees are also a significant source of methane emissions, according to a study by researchers at the Yale School of Forestry. So by utilizing those diseased trees, we are greatly reducing methane emissions as well. Now, I'm going to describe the work we do, North Carolina Forestry, it's the name of my company. Just in 2018, our forestry work. The two main services we provide are forest management plans and forest cutting plans. So last year, we did 920 acres of forest management plans and 573 acres of cutting plans, which is an average year. Timber harvest volumes and utilization. On the 573 acres, 1.5 million board feet, that's enough wood to build over 1,000 houses. 1,800 cords, that's enough firewood to heat or partially heat 354 homes, reducing the amount of heating oil by 273,000 gallons. 5,800 tons of chipboard, that is enough to produce 0.5 megawatt of power at a biomass power plant, which is enough electricity to power 375 homes for an entire year. All forest products were harvested from sustainably managed woodlots, which followed a forest management plan. The residual forest stands are now of higher quality and will grow at a much higher rate. In 10 to 15 years, timber volumes on these woodlots will be at least as high as before they were cut. So we are not only improving woodlots, but we are also providing landowners with a source of income, encouraging them to keep their land and forest, improving wildlife habitat, and maintaining many real green jobs right up the wood supply chain. The multiplier effect is huge. But imagine if we can improve 50,000 acres a year. That should be the state's minimum goal. Now, our forests are not as productive as they could be because of overcrowding, insect and disease agents, storm damage, non-native invasive plants, and the legacy of destructive high-grade logging. The hemlock woolly adelgid and emerald ash borer have put over 3 billion board feet of timber just in Massachusetts at risk, while the resurgent gypsy moth caterpillar has defoliated over 1 million acres in southern New England, causing widespread tree mortality. Innovative Natural Resource Solutions did a biomass study for the 20-town area in northwestern Mass, and calculated that 400,000 tons a year could easily be harvested from a wood pellet plant in those towns alone. They also said that 60% of the standing timber is low-grade junk. In my experience, a little higher. The most recent U.S. Forest Service forest inventory for Mass said that forests in our state are growing almost 5 times as fast as they are being cut. However, tree mortality is triple that of removals. Over 2.5 million tons of timber are dying in our forests every year, releasing all those millions of tons of CO2. So there is a huge abundance of dead, dying, junk timber. We need markets for at least 2 million tons a year. So anything you can do to increase those markets would really be appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, Mary Booth.
Hi. Mary Booth, Partnership for Policy Integrity. Thanks for being here again. I want to just address a couple of things that have come up already, and I'll just go through my list here. The issue of waste wood. I'm not sure if people maybe in this room or generally understand exactly how much wood a large-scale biomass power plant consumes with a low-efficiency plant. And actually, the Palmer plant is a good example. It's not even a low efficiency. It's actually quite high efficiency for an electric-only plant. That's a 42-megawatt plant. They're claiming they're going to be able to accomplish something like 26.7% efficiency or maybe even higher than that. They're going to burn 490,000 tons of wood a year. So for a chip van that delivers about 22 tons. That's 2 to 3 trucks per hour, every hour of the year, pulling in and dumping their load. So that's a lot of wood. I'm not confident that the wood that they'll be burning is not forestry wood, but even if it's not, brings me to my next point, which is this issue of residues and what constitutes residues and what is the actual carbon footprint of burning residues. I happen to have published a paper on this in the peer-reviewed literature. I know more about residues and residue decomposition than I really want to know. The calculator that you're using assumes that residues are basically evaporating out of the soil at such a rate, it's like seltzer water. Stuff doesn't break down that fast. It breaks down quickly if you have low diameter material or green material, but you're classifying already and are proposing to reclassify an enormous amount of high diameter material as residues. This isn't legitimate, and you should use decomposition constants that are appropriate to the actual decomposition rate of this material and do the equations properly. You're also eliminating the multi-year assessment for the greenhouse gas calculation, which is not legitimate, and we're going to be challenging you on that. I just looked at the ISO New England dashboard for the energy mix in real time of how we're getting our energy in New England. Right now, it's pretty typical for this time of day when I check it, it's around 8% renewable energy. And when you click on that renewable energy, it tells you what the breakdown is. And right now, it's 2% landfill gas, 42% garbage burning, and 31% wood, for a total of 75% of our so-called renewable energy in New England, as we speak, being generated by burning things. 22% is wind, and a whopping 2% is solar right now. Now, there are more households in Massachusetts that are still burning coal for energy than are heating with solar. I realize this is not a hearing about the heating standard. That was before. But the point is, we need to massively increase solar. It is ridiculous and wasteful to be throwing more money at this loser industry that does nothing but take money from ratepayers to prop up these failing plants. And it's not just the Palmer plant that's going to qualify. If you wipe out the efficiency requirement, a bunch of plants in Maine and New Hampshire are going to qualify, existing plants that are already operating. We're going to be throwing millions and millions of dollars at subsidizing and propping up these failing plants on the backs of Massachusetts ratepayers. That's inexcusable. We can do better, and we should do better. My last comment is about the amount of wood being harvested in Massachusetts already. I'm pretty sure the DOER has no concept, really, truly, a good number of how many households are actually burning wood for energy and how much wood is being harvested for that. The feds do collect some information on this, as I'm sure you're aware. The American Community Survey and the Energy Information Administration collects data on this. It varies, and it varies a lot year to year. Sometimes it increased 33% between 2011 and 2013. Right now, it's around 30,000 to 40,000 households, according to the ACS. It's probably more, according to EIA. Are depending on wood for fuel for primary heating, and that doesn't count secondary heating. That use of wood for energy shows up in our carbon accounts. Massachusetts carbon accounting and inventory reporting shows that current harvesting for firewood is eroding our carbon sink and diminishing it by about a third. If you increase the amount of wood that's burned, it'll degrade our carbon sink further. Just because you're not counting it in the energy sector, it is being counted in the land sector. When you diminish a sink, it has the exact same effect from the atmosphere's point of view as increasing a source. And so we can't just pretend this isn't having an effect. It does have an effect. And I think we really, As you know, I think that DOER should withdraw these regulations. I think it's extremely ill-conceived to be rewriting something that is working fine. There were a couple of plants that got certified under the existing set of regulations that incentivizes high-efficiency biomass. There's no reason to fool with that. Now, if you want to improve the regulations and streamline them a little bit, I'm sure lots of people would be sympathetic to that, and we'd be happy to work with you on that. But as I said yesterday, this was a four-year process to put those rules in place. It involved a lot of volunteer time from a lot of people and a lot of effort. And for you guys to just unilaterally decide to do this in your office in Boston with apparently no idea or concept of the history of this and how it came to be, it's not good. It's not a good look. So I think the OER can and should do better. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, Kirsty Petchy.
Good afternoon. My name is Kirsty Petchy. I'm the director of the Zero Waste Program at the Conservation Law Foundation. My colleague, Caitlin Peel Stone, spoke on a Monday regarding biomass. I'm in 100% agreement with the testimony that Ms. Booth just gave. I'm also a resident of Sturbridge, and I think that while there's definitely a burden sometimes on municipalities to better tend their trees and deal with wood waste, I think that many town managers and also town arborists like Mr. Chamberlain don't realize the effect this would have on our forests and our energy system large scale. But today I'm really here to speak about incineration of waste, solid waste. And I would like to refer you, we will be submitting written documents, written testimony. I think the deadline is now the 7th. And I will make sure that we get that to you. And I would like to let you know that we're basing our written and this oral testimony on information that was created not only by the DEP, Mass DEP, they commissioned a TELUS report in 2009 that evaluated the burning of waste as compared to, and including the burning of waste, plasma arc, gasification, and pyrolysis burning, as well as straight up incineration, what they like to call waste energy. All of those types of high heat with low heat and then also recycling other zero waste programs, reduction, composting, and recycling. And we found what DEP found, the TELUS Institute found, was that there's no question that incineration of all sorts is a loser. I would also like to refer you to a recent paper that the Boston College Law School published, A Dirty Waste, How Renewable Energy Policies Have Financed the Unsustainable Waste Energy Industry. I'll attach that as an attachment for written comments. To summarize all of those reports and very briefly for you. Waste incineration emits more uncontrolled pollution than coal-fired power plants, 28 times as much dioxin, possibly the most dangerous chemical known to man, 2.5 times as much carbon monoxide, 3 times as much nitrogen oxide, 6 to 14 times as much mercury, also incredibly dangerous, as you know, nearly 6 times as much lead, and 70% more sulfur dioxides. High heat incineration of all kinds requires landfill still. You have not solved your landfill problem just because you burn the waste. 25% of the waste, so if I burn 400 tons of waste, you need 100 tons of ash disposal. So you have not solved your landfill problem if you're burning your waste. Incineration, including all the new types of incineration like gasification, pyrolysis, and plasma arc, are the most expensive waste management alternatives. And unless those facilities, when they're built new, require municipalities in the region to basically ignore improving their composting and recycling systems and lock into a contract with that new facility to provide and feed the beast, to provide the waste to feed the beast, they go out of business. And we've seen this around the world. Furthermore, just to give you a couple other important points, the high heat conversion technologies are no better than incineration when it comes to pollution. So in other words, if we heat waste to the point where it then becomes a fuel and burn it then. We have not solved the problem environmentally. And all incinerators are incompatible with recycling and waste goals. Please remember that 80%, by the most conservative estimates, about 75-80% of the waste stream are recyclable or compostable materials. 20-22% are food scraps. Another 8% are yard waste. Those materials should be composted. Furthermore, 11% plastics, entirely unrenewable in any way, shape, or form, and very toxic to burn. And then paper and cardboard should be recycled. That's probably another 20% of the material that we're now throwing away. And 40% of what we're putting into our incinerators in Massachusetts are waste-banned items that are not allowed to be burned. So we see from our waste characterization studies that the incinerators do themselves, they are burning stuff that's supposed to be recycled, that should be composted, and in fact is often required to be recycled. So we have a waste problem in Massachusetts. It's not being solved by the existence of incinerators. Finally, the incinerators are a massive waste of energy. Think about what's in your waste stream, as I said, that food and those other materials. Because it's so heterogeneous, not only does it cause a problem when we're trying to keep the waste out of the airstream or out of the ash, there's no real way to make sure that we're keeping that airshed clean because we've got too many different types of things you're burning, but also it causes a real problem in trying to have a consistent burn rate. And as a result, it's a very low efficiency rate, something like 19-27%. Last 2 points, burning waste contributes to climate change, not surprising. If biomass is not sustainable and renewable, which it is not, certainly waste energy is not sustainable or renewable. Many of those materials are literally irreplaceable. Once you burn them, you cannot make them again. We're running out of them. And the rates are just absolutely horrible, which we'll get into in our written comments. Finally, the 7 incinerators in Massachusetts, 6 of them are in environmental justice communities. And by environmental justice communities, I mean communities where people are impoverished, or English isn't their first language, or they're people of color. That is not an accident. These are filthy, filthy, filthy facilities. You would not want to live next to one of them. And as a result, we are burdening these communities that don't have as much power as other communities in our state. So, last example to leave you with, the oldest incinerator, waste incinerator in the country is in Saugus, Massachusetts, which is an impoverished EJ community. It is in the middle of Revere, Saugus, and Chelsea, right on the water. There's also an ash landfill there that's in a marsh. That incinerator recently, when DEP changed the regulations, or there are federal regulations that DEP is promulgating, requiring different NOx standards, that incinerator submitted information to Liberator Saugus, said they could not meet those standards because their boilers are just too old. It was built in 1974. You're not using the same car or foam that you did in 1974. These incinerators in Massachusetts are old, polluting, expensive, and need to be phased out. They should not be propped up by subsidies or encouraged in any way, shape, or form. Thank you very much for your time. Conservation Law Foundation is happy to answer any questions. If you need any further information, we will, as I said, submit probably lengthy written comments for you, which I'm sure you're excited about. And thank you very much for your patience today.
Thank you. Next, Michael Kellett.
Hi, thanks for giving me the opportunity to speak. I'm Michael Kellett. I live in Westford, Mass. I'm speaking on behalf of Restore the North Woods. We're a nonprofit organization based in Concord, Mass. We have members all across the state. Restore strongly opposes the proposed changes in the RPS regulations. It's well established that burning trees and garbage for energy worsens global warming, leads to more air pollution, takes money away from clean energy technologies. The current regulations took these facts into account. They're not perfect, but we thought they were pretty decent. So the question is, why is DOER suddenly proposing these changes out of the blue in these regulations that would dramatically increase biomass burning? The answer to it seems to us to be that the forestry, woody biomass, and waste incineration industries have been aggressively pushing for these changes, because the public certainly hasn't been. These industries claim that by boosting the market for low-grade wood, expanded biomass burning will help prevent the decline of the Massachusetts forest products and biomass industries and make them more profitable. In fact, the opposite is true in Maine, which has been heavily subsidizing its logging and biomass industries for years, yet it has lost two-thirds of its forest industry jobs and closed biomass plants right and left. These industries claim that boosting the low-grade wood market would maintain options for forest landowners to keep their forest land as forest. In fact, the UMass study found that logging their forest does not have any impact on whether or not landowners keep their forest as forest. The industries claim that wood energy would remove logging debris that would otherwise rot and worsen climate change. In fact, removing tops and branches left over from logging degrades wildlife habitat, impoverishes soils, increases erosion and water pollution, and the RPS regulations ignore emissions, on the other hand, from wood chip piles, for example, at biomass power plants, which are emitting greenhouse gases. The biomass industry wants us to think that they really want these subsidies, the public subsidies, to expand the market for low-grade wood, which will increase their profits. The biomass waste industry, biomass and waste to energy industry, want public biomass subsidies because without them, their industries are not economically competitive. Fact is that this industry-driven change in the regulations will worsen climate change, harm forest health, and make people sick from air pollution. So gutting these regulations may be good for industry profits, but it's bad for the people of Massachusetts, and we urge DOER to withdraw these ill-conceived changes in the regulations. Restore will be submitting full comments in writing, and thanks for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you. Next, Bob Armstrong.
My name is Bob Armstrong. I'm a selectman in Conway, and I chair the climate crisis group in Franklin County. And I congratulate you on having a microphone today. Very quick comment on the RPS. So the RPS was written to incentivize nascent, young, struggling technologies like solar and wind that needed some help. The RPS was not written for these old burning technologies like burning wood. The RPS uses this word renewable, and I think it's kind of unfortunate that we're using the word renewable in a sense that we might as well call oil renewable. Our Earth is still making oil. It's only that it makes it on a very slow scale. Our Earth is still growing trees. But they take 100 years, long time, until we grow new trees. Trees are not a renewable resource. We have two groups of people that are testifying here today, and I sort of think of them as being Team Climate and Team Forest. And Team Climate is here talking about We need to make electricity cleanly. We should subsidize technologies that make it cleanly. We need to worry about the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And Team Forest is here with lots of issues having to do with trying to fund their town and how they're going to pay for getting rid of the wastes in their town from land clearing and cutting down trees. That's an important problem. But it's not the problem to be solved by the RPS. The RPS is to encourage clean electricity. So we have these two teams. Marked difference here on what their goals are. You guys are clearly now in Team Forest. When I tried to describe this to my friends, they are appalled that the group in charge of the RPS is Team Forest. That's what you guys talk like, sound like, and that's what these regulations are showing us. The really unfortunate part of this is that means that we are going to have to go back and solve this problem in a different way. What you guys are doing in the APS has caused us to put some legislation forward to remove biomass from the APS. That's an extreme thing to have to do, but it's the only thing we can do when you guys make changes like you're making to the RPS. And when we encouraged the Energy Committee to include the RPS, they seem to agree with us, like that's a good idea. I don't know if what you want is that we're going to completely remove biomass from the RPS. But it's what we're going to have to do. Thank you.
Thank you. That's the last person I had who had signed up for testifying. We have a bit more time here. Is there anyone who hasn't signed up that would like to speak? No? Is there anyone else that has any other comments that they'd like to put onto the record? Okay. With that, then, we'll conclude this hearing then. Thank you.